This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a highly acclaimed actor, writer, filmmaker, and singer-songwriter who's well-remembered for his portrayal of counterterrorist unit director Bill Buchanan on the blockbuster TV show 24, for which he and his fellow cast members were nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award for Outstanding Performance by an Ensemble in a Drama Series. He was also a series regular on Those Who Kill and Space Above and Beyond, and he had recurring roles on Freedom, Twin Peaks, Private Practice, Blue, Revenge, and Hawthorne, in addition to guest star appearances in dozens of great TV shows like Law & Order SVU, NCIS, Suits, The West Wing, 6 Feet Under, The X-Files, and many more. He's also appeared in some wonderful TV movies and miniseries, including Fatal Vision, North and South Book 2, Good Cops, Bad Cops, Without Warning, The Wonder Cabinet, and Seeds of Destruction, to name only a few. On the big screen, he's appeared in many terrific movies, including Shadow of Doubt, Shadows of the Past, The One, Catch Me If You Can, Jarhead, The Jazz Funeral, Doubting Thomas, Road to Dreamland, and Relish, which won a whole slew of prestigious film festival awards. Along with his wife, acclaimed filmmaker Riyadh Galayini, he's made 3 multi-award-winning short films, Parking, Nude Descending, and Crossing, as well as a fascinating and highly compelling documentary called Showing Up, which features many iconic actors talking about the audition process. The film is part of the curriculum at more than 200 colleges and universities throughout North America. Our guest is also a highly accomplished playwright, having had his plays developed and produced by some of the most prestigious theater companies in the world. And as an actor in the theater, he's appeared on stage in dozens of celebrated theatrical productions throughout America, in London's West End, and at the Edinburgh Festival. And for his work on stage, he's received the Los Angeles Drama Critics Circle Award and 3 Drama Logue Awards. He also wrote and performed his intensely personal one-man play, Leave Your Fears Here, which recounts his beloved son's struggle with and ultimate recovery from brain cancer. And if all of that weren't enough, he's also a terrific singer and songwriter who's recorded a wonderful album, Son to the Boy, which is available on every major streaming platform. I am delighted and honored to welcome James Morrison to our show. James, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Harvey. Wow, that was a wonderful introduction. Thanks.
What goes through your mind when you hear all those credits?
Well, I got a little tired, actually. I think I need a nap now. I don't know. Well, it's funny that you should ask me that, because now, you know, it's a little slow right now and I haven't worked in a minute, as is the case, you know, for actors usually. And so you start thinking, geez, what have I done? You know, what am I doing? You ask yourself that quite a bit. What the hell am I doing here? Anyway, I'm happy to be here in this moment with you. Thank you.
Well, we're very happy to have you. Now, you were born in Utah, raised in Anchorage, Alaska. You studied acting in New York, but before doing your apprenticeship at the Alaska Repertory Theater, you were a clown in the circus, which is so interesting to me because I don't really think of you as a comedic actor. Why haven't you done more comedies?
Yeah, that's a good question. And usually when I do get hired to do a, you know, like a sitcom or something, I'm usually the straight guy. So, you know, I don't really know how that turned out. I think I sort of carry a natural sort of darkness and intensity that I can't seem to get rid of. And I don't know, that may be it. It's funny you should mention that. And I knew you would bring it up. And people usually say, what, you know, happened, or what possessed you, or how did that come about? And, you know, it's been so long, it's been 50 years now. And I can't really remember what drove me to that decision. I think it had something to do with the romanticism of running away to join the circus, and thinking that in lieu of a drama school or something, that kind of experience would be beneficial. It turned out to be exactly the opposite. It almost killed me, and it was a horrific experience. So looking back on it now, I think it was maybe, you know, a couple of good stories from it, but I really don't know what possessed me to do that.
Well, I hope you get to do more comedies. I can see that, well, you're very versatile, so it wouldn't surprise me at all. But when I look at your resume and your body of work, I get the impression that despite your hundreds of performances in front of the camera and movies on TV, your first love is the theater. Am I right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's where I started, back in Anchorage, where we moved when I was 9. And I'm always drawn back to the stage.
Well, even though you
It,
love doing live theater, does it ever boggle your mind that in doing one episode of a TV show like 24, you'll be seen and recognized by more people than all of the audience who have ever seen you on the stage in all the shows you've ever done? How does
I
that
know.
feel?
It, well, you know, it feels. It's interesting when you, the odd occasion that you'll be out and somebody will, you'll get that look, that look when somebody recognizes you. I'm sure you get it, and you go, okay, well, you don't get that from the theater. You don't get that from your stage work, but when it's happening, when you're on stage and you're in that moment, that moment of connection between you and that person sitting out there, even if it's only one person. It really doesn't matter because it doesn't exist until that happens. What we do as actors doesn't exist until it connects with you. And when that happens in the moment, there's nothing like it. I remember a story, my acting teacher, Harry Master George, 40 years we were friends and collaborators. Before I started working in television, or had done anything on film, I was in class, and this was 1983 or two. And I said, just offhandedly, I said, I'd really like to do something that can reach people, a larger audience, and that's something that's recorded in time. And he said, well, now wait a minute. I saw you in that play, the Stephen Burkoff play, and I will never forget that. It's indelibly engraved in my memory, and it made me realize what theater does to us. I mean, your theater experiences—you'll never forget some of the impressions that those actors and playwrights have made on you. And so it made me reevaluate that whole feeling of how many people see you and how far your reach is as an actor. Because if you reach one person, it can change their lives.
How can you tell when you're on the stage if you're reaching people?
Well, I don't know, but you can tell when you're not. I mean, I don't know if that makes sense, but it, when you're bombing, and when you've got them, as they say, in the palm of your hand. If it's a feeling that you get when, you can sense that, the sense of them sort of leaning forward in their seats a little bit. It's a palpable energy, and I think that's what we're talking about.
And when you're in front of the camera, you don't get any kind of immediate feedback other than from maybe the crew or the director.
No, you don't even get that. I mean, you can't because they. I mean, if you do, they'll ruin the take. If you get a laugh when you're doing a movie, or usually everybody's so busy doing their own job as they should be. It's that collaboration, working up to the time between action and cut. But then when it's over, everybody's got to move on to the next thing, and if you don't hear anything from the director, it's usually a good thing. It's the stage is the actor's medium. It's you out there, as my friend Pat Hingle, used to say, there go the galloping actors, and it's their time.
Well, it's very magical to see live theater. I want to ask you about a movie you made in 1999 with Ernest Borgnine, Shadows of the Past. Did you
Oh,
get
sure,
to
yeah.
know him at all?
Somewhat we were in the sort of in the boondocks of Texas, and not much to do. So we did talk some. He was sort of solitary. We both were, and our characters, didn't really connect. So that sometimes that dictates how you connect with the actor. Sometimes you're off on your own and doing your work. But that was an interesting film, and a great story that David Lynch also made a movie of. At about the same time, about the guy who travels across the country on his lawnmower to see his brother, and it's based on a true story, and both these films were made simultaneously. And of course, David Lynch's, because of the higher profile studio picture sort of took precedence over ours, which was unfortunate because it's a really sweet movie.
Oh yeah, Shadows of the Past is a great movie. And of course, Catch Me If You Can. What was it like being directed by Steven Spielberg?
You know, it was actually pretty wonderful, especially since I was only there a couple of days. You know, I didn't really, you know, like I say, I didn't really, when you don't hear from a director, you know, you've sort of done it. Sometimes they'll say, yeah, great job, or, you know, congratulate you, thank you. But for the most part, they're busy. And I got that feeling from Steven. I prepared, you know, the pilot that Leonardo sees that inspires him to become a pilot. So that was my role. And I, you know, the script called for me to whistle a tune as I was getting into the elevator with this bevy of beautiful, you know, flight attendants. And I practiced for days trying to learn the song to whistle it. I'm not a very good whistler anyway, so it was nerve-wracking. And I got to the set, and he called me over and said, "Let me hear your accent, because I think I did a Texan accent in the thing." And I said, I started talking. I don't know if I said the lines, but he said, "Okay, that's great. Now, you know, we decided we're not going to do the whistling. We're just going to send you out into the crowd, and then I'll send some kids out, and then we'll, you know, just do a little improv and see what happens, and then we'll see what we get." I said, "Okay, that'll be fun." So the whole script at that point was thrown out, and that's how that ended up playing out. And it was great. It was like suddenly I was free to just be this pilot instead of an actor who couldn't whistle, you know. And it was great. I loved working with him, actually.
That must have been a great relief not to have to do the whistling.
Yeah, it really
You
was.
know, throughout your career, James, you've portrayed a number of important historical figures. For example, in some of your audio productions, you've played General Eisenhower, William Bradford Huey, Chief Justice Dan Haywood in Judgment at Nuremberg. You've even played Julius Caesar. How do you prepare when you're playing a real person?
You know, I think you prepare the same way you do when you're not. You know, you read as much as you can. In the case of a fictional character, you read the script as many times as you can to learn and become familiar and make it mean something to you. And when you're playing Eisenhower, you read as much about Eisenhower as you can to, you know, it's interesting. And always this question always takes me back to what I remember Robert Duvall said. You know, he said, "You can do all that research and you can do, you know, the reading." And we love to learn new things, and actors love to. It's the reason, one of the reasons we became actors, is so we can pretend to be all these different people and different professions and learn these things. But he said, "You know, ultimately what it comes down to is you and the other guy." And that's really the truth. You can have all that stuff in there, but, you know, ultimately it's going to be, you know, between you, me and Harvey here, you know. So I try to remember that, because you can't learn it all. You can learn as much as you can learn in the time that you've, you know, been allotted, but so that helps to remember that.
Yeah, I would think that it would. Now, of course, I have to ask you a few questions about 24. You played CTU director Bill Buchanan. You started out as a guest star in season four and then became a regular on seasons five, six, and seven. When I was doing my research, I learned that before you joined the cast, you were not a regular watcher of the show. So how did you prepare for the audition?
How did you find that out? That's amazing. Well, your research is pretty incredible.
That's what I'm known for.
Yeah, I'll say.
I mean, I can't imagine auditioning for a series I've never seen.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it goes back to the last answer I gave you. You know, in the time allotted, you do as much research as you can, and I think I had, what, I don't know, 24 hours to watch an episode, examine the you know, what was happening in that world, which was incredible. Learn as much as I could about CTU in that short time, and with the materials they gave me. But, you know, the script, the little scene that they gave me, I think had it all. And you know, that's the basis of my training with Harry, was, if this is all you're given, you know, this is it. This is the world. And so if you bring anything else into that, you're either going to go way off track because of your subjective input. You know, I just tried to stick with what I had there. And I saw the episode Before I came aboard, there was a scene where Jack killed, I think he may have been the head of CTU or one of those suits that come in. He just shot him in the head at the rail. Remember at the railroad on the railroad tracks? And I just said, "Wow, this guy will do anything." And the show knows no, I mean, it has no,
No boundaries.
no boundaries, no stop sign. It's just going to run it, you know? So I said, okay, I think I need to do this.
But here's the thing that really amazes me. I can't recall anything you did prior to 24 which involved that level of high action storytelling. So were you surprised at how well the chemistry worked between you and the other actors and the whole subject matter of the show?
No, I think it's it again, it comes back to your willingness to just submit to the moment, and because of the real time aspect of it, that's what you have to do. You're jumping over the hands of the clock as they speed by. You're standing on this giant clock, and the second hand is ticking, and you're racing time. So I think the more you just stay in that moment, in that world, and not think about the other stuff, which can happen in an episodic thing, and when the stories jump around, and I think that was a credit to everybody in the cast, really. And I just w sort of w was willing to accept that.
Well, you joined the show in its fourth season after it was already a huge hit. I would imagine the cast and the crew already had an established dynamic and a rhythm. Was it challenging for you to fit in and be part of the team?
It was for a minute. Especially in those first episodes when I was just, they shot two episodes at a time. So sometimes you would, you say you were doing episode 11 and 12. In the morning, you would shoot a scene from 11, and then in the afternoon, you'd shoot a scene from 12. So that was challenging. That was a really different format. And they did have a way of shooting this that was very specific to this crew. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they had only like a 5% turnover in terms of crew in the whole time I was there. So it was a finely tuned machine. And once I learned the way they shot that was different from other television, it was pretty easy to slide into that machine. Yeah.
As you know, there were a lot of very intense storylines for your character, including being in a covert operation to uncover a government conspiracy. He tries to prevent terrorist attacks. He helps Jack with the escape of Ramon Salazar. He stops a Russian nerve gas attack. And there were lots of great power struggles in the story. I heard you say in another interview that you deliberately refrained from making storyline suggestions for your character. Why?
I didn't want to go up and be kind of a nudge and go upstairs into the offices and say, I think I have a great idea for this. What if Bill, I think it was more valuable and I would be more of service to the story to when they brought it to me, if there were moments that I could say, I think to make this sound more human, because sometimes the exposition was as brilliant as these writers were. The exposition was, and it often is, a little clunky. So, I would make those kind of suggestions. If I said, "What if I said this instead?" And they'd go, "Oh, yeah. As long as you make sure to put syntax gas and Jack is here in this thing, yeah, figure it out." And they trusted me to do that. They trusted a few of us to do that. Not a lot of us, but a few. Once they realized that we could, write as well. But I think the bigger stuff, I mean, I felt just grateful to be there, and I didn't want to, I knew that was their baby, and they were really good at that.
I can see why you were considered a writer's dream. And what about Bill Buchanan's death? That was such a shocking and unforgettable scene. He met his demise by heroically sacrificing himself to create an explosion that defeated Juma's attack on the White House. How did you feel about the way Bill Buchanan left the show?
Oh, I felt pretty good about that actually, and I, as sad as it was to have to leave, because I really did enjoy that job a lot, and I enjoyed working with those people. I just wanted to, I think that was one time, the only time actually, that I suggested anything to do with, and it wasn't really a plot point, but I just said, can you make it a good one? Just I mean, he's a guy. As that character developed, and as I grew fonder of it, of doing it, I just thought, can you? And he said, yeah, we absolutely will. So, and they did, and I was grateful for that. It was a heroic death, and I was grateful for that.
Oh, it was spectacular. It was unforgettable. Now, the public reaction to 24 was frequently as intense as the show itself. There were critics saying the show promoted bigotry against Muslim Americans and that it glamorized the use of torture. And some people felt the show was negatively influencing government policy and even military policy. Do you think there was ever any validity to those criticisms?
In hindsight, I can see where they would say that, because of the administration at the time the show was on the air was vocal about it. I think Dick Cheney said something about it being a, we need more Jack Bowers or something silly like that. Because no, we actually don't. We don't need any Jack Bowers. That was a, I mean, listen, it was a wonderful character, a fictional character, but it was made for fiction. That's the kind of thing we go to for escapism. It's not the kind of thing that inspires us to live our lives. So, dedication to job, maybe, but I think, yeah, there's probably validity in that. But there were lots of people on the other side of the political spectrum that were fans of the show too. I would get calls from Jack O'Brien, the director, Broadway director, an old friend of mine for 40 years. Jimmy, we have Monday night viewings in C Connecticut of your show. I mean, because it was before streaming, so they would have these parties every Monday night to watch 24. So, I think I think you could probably make that case that it was a, I don't know, a far right wing, war fantasy thing. And it's unfortunate, anytime a show gets nailed for what might be considered an anti-Muslim or any kind of discrimination bias, that's drama. I mean, we see it all the time. It's conflict. And if you're going to create anything that has to do with the zeitgeist, it's going to cover that stuff.
Yeah, I think it really drew a very excellent line between fantasy and possibility in a very compelling way. I mean, people really, it was an event watching that show. Every episode was an event.
And before I joined, as I remember, there was a plane in the pilot. I think there was a plane explosion or a plane using a plane for some kind of terror. And it was before, wasn't it just like they made it before 9/11 and it came and it was supposed to air about the same time? It was kind of a,
It was surreal,
it
really.
was it was surreal, because it was kind of a Nostradamus television show, wasn't it?
So you've been a freelance actor most of your career. It must have felt great to have steady employment for such a long time. What was it like for you after your time on the show ended?
It was nice because, I was getting offers to do things that I hadn't happened before. So people had seen my work on the show, and they would call for me to do certain things. But shortly after that, I didn't have much time to really think about that, because shortly after that is when my son fell ill. So I didn't, the outside world sort of stopped, and we became we were distracted.
Well, to say the least. Now, that play that you did about your son, the reverberations from the intensity of what you were able to do on that stage are still out there. I wonder if you'll ever make a movie of that play.
I'd like to record the play someday. Yeah.
Yeah, I really, really hope you do. I want to ask you about your documentary feature, Showing Up, which
Sure.
I couldn't get enough of, even though I'm not an actor. It has a very impressive cast of about 60 renowned actors talking about the audition process. What inspired you and your wife to make that movie? I loved it.
Oh, thanks. What inspired me was a conversation I was having with an actor at the Old Globe. Speaking of Jack O'Brien, back in the mid-80s, I was talking to a wonderful character actor named Tom Lacey, lives in New York. And he was telling me about this audition that he had that was, and everybody has their audition stories. But this one was so funny and so embarrassing, it blew my mind. And we went on stage, and I think we were sitting around in our tights in the green room talking about this. And then we went on stage and did some Shakespeare and came back. And I said, you know, I think it'd make a really kind of a cool book. First it was an idea for a book, but it would be actors in their own words telling the stories. And I was talking to a friend, and Riad and I had talked about this too. And we were all talking and said, you know, but actors are such great storytellers. Let's have them tell their stories, if they have them. So it started out being kind of an audition story experiment, you know.
Well, for
And
people
that's
who haven't seen it, the list of people in that movie, Kristen Chenoweth, Nathan Lane, Chris Messina, Sam Rockwell, Eli Wallach, and that's just naming a few. Was it difficult getting them to participate?
No, it wasn't. We had a great casting director in New York, Jim Carnahan. And Kate Bocca, his partner, when we were in New York, would just get on the phone, call their friends and say, you know, James Morrison and his wife are in town and they want to talk to you about the audition. Be there tomorrow at 3 o'clock. They're at the rehearsal studios on, you know, 49th Street. And that's how it went in New York. Now, in LA, it was different. They weren't as willing to come in. We had to go through their agents. So we mostly and they said, you know, what are you going to pay him? And we said, well, it's a documentary, so it's, oh, no, they're not interested. Click, you know, it was a different, I mean, you know, the difference in the coasts and the mentality. Or we just call our friends in. That was part of it.
Well, what a Rolodex of friends you have, sir. And I want to tell our viewers, you can see the film Showing Up by going to the website, showingupmovie.com. And even if you're not an actor, you'll find the film very impactful because you'll realize as you listen to these actors that we're all auditioning for something throughout our lives, and that the concept of showing up and giving it your all, no matter what the result, is a very important life lesson. So I highly recommend the movie. You know, James, it's ironic that you made this movie because I know you almost turned down the chance to audition for 24 because you were supposed to go on vacation to Hawaii with your family. So, is there a lesson in there for actors when it comes to scheduling your personal life?
Oh, sure. The first lesson is anytime you schedule a vacation, you're going to get an audition that you might have to stay for. So schedule lots of vacations. That's my advice. You know, I guess the biggest lesson is, you never know what's going to come of going the extra mile. And also, in fact, going back to showing up, you know, when we first started filming it, we thought, what's this going to be about? It can't just be about the audition. Can it be about the undercurrent of events that we don't know are happening from one audition that you didn't get the job? And then years later, something comes up and they go, you know, I remember that audition you did for me 10 years ago, and I kept you in mind. But then as you get older, you know, I say that, and by all means, you know, I would say weigh your decision to go in for stuff carefully. But then, you know, as you do this a while and you start getting stuff and you realize, you know, I don't think so. There are different reasons for turning stuff down, and you have the power of no and all that stuff. But I would say, generally speaking, anytime you get an audition, do your best, man. Give it 110% and be completely present and willing to play, because you never know what's going to come down the road.
And if you've scheduled a vacation, be prepared to sacrifice it. Although I want to give a shout out to your manager, my dear friend Mitch Klem, who, in my opinion, has got to be the nicest guy in show business. He's the
I agree.
one who told you not to miss out on that audition for 24, right?
Yeah, he did. He made sure that in fact, he called and changed my reservation for my flight. He said, no, you've got to send your family to Hawaii without you. You got to stay behind and do this. But the biggest thing he did, and you'll appreciate this knowing Mitch, was when it came down to them deciding to or not to hire me, because this all happened at sort of Christmas time, so there was a delay. And they said, you know, he's already on a Fox show, so we can't put him on 24. We really liked him and we want him, but we can't do it because Fox has a rule that you can't be on two Fox shows at the same time. So, and I wasn't even a regular. I was a recurring thing on Point Pleasant, I think it was. And Mitch wrote them a letter, speaking of going the extra mile. And he said, listen, this guy is perfect for this part. I know the show. You want him. He wants to do this. The stars are aligning. You know, we've got to see this happening. And they took that letter to heart. and sort of made it happen, I think, based on that, his extra little nudge. So thanks, Mitch.
God bless you, Mitch.
Yeah.
So, James, at this stage of your career, do you still have to audition for roles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about the current practice of self-taping auditions instead of doing it in person?
I enjoyed going into the room and getting that feeling, like, and showing up. Stephen Spinella, I think, talks about, you can tell when you walk into a room, you can tell in the first few seconds whether or not they decided they didn't want you for this. You don't even have to open your mouth. And that feeling go and the opposite is true also. You can walk into a room and go, you know what, I think before you even do the scene, I think there might be something to this. And you can't get that feeling, of course, on a in a self-tape. There's no interaction. I mean, even this right now, I mean, I can tell from our interactions here that we'd get along really well, and we'd probably have a friendship if we had a if the you know or a great collaborative working experience at the very least.
Oh, for sure.
So
But I wonder,
you
like,
can't.
have you ever had an audition where you got the feeling that the people you're auditioning for don't even know what they're looking for?
Oh yeah.
Well, how do
A
you
lot of
deal
times
with
they
that?
don't. A lot of times they don't. I mean, they really don't until it walks into the room. I say it, until the person, the human being, walks into the room. They don't really know until they see it. They know what they think they're looking for based on what they wrote, perhaps, but sometimes they'll have a different idea, and when you walk in, they'll go, "Oh my God, I didn't even consider this. This is the guy. This is the woman that we've been looking for." And so it's, that's why being in the room, I think, is so valid.
You are not alone. Every actor tells me that. I wish they would go back to real auditions in front
Yeah,
of real people.
but at the same time, I love having the control of, I guess it's, being a filmmaker too. I love having the control of being able to do numerous takes if I don't feel good about it. Sometimes cutting two things together and then deciding which one I want to send. I mean, that's, knowing how to light it. I mean, all that stuff is valuable too. So I don't know.
So, what about James Morrison, the playwright, the storyteller? What drives your creativity as a writer?
I think it comes from wanting to see something that I would want to see. I mean, wanting to create something that I would want to see. Because if you don't, you have to do it for yourself first. I mean, I'm sure you feel the way that way in your interview. You have the format and the person. You're bringing your truest self to this experience because that's what you would want to see, right?
Exactly.
So that's, I think, what drives me as a writer or a creator of anything, really. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I think there are a lot of people who start from that, because if we go the other way and we start second guessing what people want to see, we end up with, well, the majority of the stuff you see, I think, is driven by the size of the audience. Here's how we get the butts in the seats and things like that. But if you write something from your real true self and it comes from your soul, I think that's the best. That's the stuff that moves us, isn't it?
Well, keep doing it because what you want to see seems to be what we want to see. Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, you're a wonderful singer-songwriter. I really love your album, Son to the Boy.
Oh,
I can
thanks.
hear the influence of Bob Dylan and the Beatles, country rock artists like Buffalo Springfield, even Johnny Cash. Did you ever consider focusing primarily on music instead of acting when you were a young man just starting out?
No, I never did. I mean,
How come?
I don't know. I think because, I mean, I certainly was influenced by those people. Certainly. I mean, when I saw, like most boys especially, but people my age who saw the Beatles, for instance, on Ed Sullivan, it changed our lives. And we all ran out and got guitars, and went into the garage and started a band, But I think when I discovered acting, or that it was a thing that you could do, making believe that you're some, and I'd done this as a child, I've done it all my life. But when I finally said, wow, I guess you could do that for a living, pretend to be somebody else and in a make-believe, world. I mean, that's, so it just wasn't the same. It seemed like the opportunity, I could pretend to be a rock and roll musician, in other words. And but I couldn't do that if I was just a rock and roll musician. I couldn't pretend to be an actor. Does that make sense?
No, it does. Because when you're in music, I don't think you're pretending at all.
Right.
You're
Oh,
going to
yeah.
be authentic.
And you know, it's funny you say that because I had such a severe case of performance anxiety when I was doing my music live that I would finally I went through this period where I said, you know, I have to approach this like an acting role. I have to pretend to be, I mean, I'm a storyteller. I just happen to be singing my story this time. And so I didn't come up with a persona, but I had to pretend like I was acting a role, you know, and it all went away.
Well, when we've had other actors on the show who sing, most recently we had Tim Russ, they've all said that it's exceedingly difficult to be taken seriously as a musician in the industry because you've been pigeonholed as an actor. Do you agree with that?
I suppose there's some truth to that. You know, there are those who've sort of broken out of that. Keith Carradine did pretty well back in the day. I mean, because of, you know, he did it in a movie. I mean, his breakout was in Nashville. That's where he broke out as a singer-songwriter. And then they had hits, but I guess you get typecast. Sure, they typecast you in many other ways. Why wouldn't they typecast you as that?
Well, it's just so weird because music artists seem to have no problem being accepted as actors. Look at Frank Sinatra, Elvis, Cher, Madonna, Lady Gaga, David Bowie. Singers can get jobs acting, but for actors, it's much tougher to be accepted as a music artist. To me, it just doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why that is. Perhaps it's a level of all those people you mentioned had a level of fame coming into the actor. So maybe it's, I mean, I'm just theorizing here. But maybe it's because they, you know, listen, David Bowie in a movie. Although we didn't feel the same way with Dylan or Mick Jagger, they didn't have the same success. I think it's that just that those people were incredibly talented, you know, actors as well. I mean, you know, Bowie's actually a pretty good actor, and so is Lady Gaga.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're feeling creative, James, and you have something important to say, how do you decide whether to write a play or a song?
I think it comes from the genesis of the idea. Sometimes a song will happen from one line that you think, and you write it down, and you go, you know, I think there's a verse for that. Boy, that's a good question, Harvey.
Well, it's
And
fascinating to
I
us,
don't
the
know the
audience. You know,
answer.
the audience, you're such a creative person and you have that option that you can do both. So it must
Yeah.
be quite an exercise in your mind.
If you ruminate on something long enough, it'll tell you what it needs to be. Sometimes a short film can come from a song. I mean, you've seen plenty of music videos that are wrapped around a short film idea. So I don't know. I mean, but that's an interesting question. How do you know? You just.
Well, here's another interesting question for you.
Okay.
You are very well known for being a yoga teacher. You taught yoga for 10 years in LA. Does yoga help you with your acting or your writing or your singing?
Oh, you know, yeah, absolutely. It really helped me when I was on 24. Because it was, as you can imagine, it was so stressful and the circumstance. And sometimes, truth be told, there were moments on the set that were tense. So if I didn't have the breath work and if I didn't have the knowledge, I guess, and the willingness to just sit in silence and meditate on gratitude or find the balance, you know, between the opposing forces. And I learned all that through yoga. So sure, I was also teaching during that time, so that helped. I felt like I was being of service, you know, because you can't, as they say, keep it if you don't give it away. So that helped me during that time. Oh, absolutely. It keeps me balanced
And focused.
and focus. Sure, yeah.
When you're going through a period where you may not have a lot of work lined up, do you worry about it? Or are you confident that with your reputation in the industry, I mean, everybody loves you, everyone wants to work with you, you're known for being a team player, you have no ego, you know your lines, you're a pro. Do you trust that the right thing will come along, or do you worry about it?
The only time I worry about it is if I'm, and this isn't part of my practice. This is part of my yoga practice, basically. is if I don't stay in the moment, if I don't stay in the present moment, and it's hard. It's hard to do, to practice gratitude. If I feel the least bit out of that practice, that's when I start to worry about it. Because, I have no control over that. The only time I ever start to worry is when I start thinking about things I have no control over.
But you've got Mitch. You never have to worry.
No, that's true, yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, James, it's been a real pleasure meeting you and having this chance to celebrate your amazing career. I hope you're feeling the gratitude I'm conveying to you because you've given us some great performances over the years. But most of all, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Oh, Harvey, you're wonderful. And I'm so grateful that you asked me to sit down with you for this time. It's been a pure joy. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been the mega and multi-talented James Morrison. For more information about Mr. Morrison, please visit his official website, thejamesmorrison.com. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli of the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my editor, Isaiah Charalampadis, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary, while supplies last. Tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.